Good morning. My name's Rod Keenan, and I'd like to welcome you all here today. And it's great to see such a broad-ranging group of people present for our first annual forum of the Victorian Centre for Climate Change Adaptation Research. I'd like to pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people, and their elders past and present. I think, and I'd like to extend those respects to any other Indigenous people who are here today. I think we've much to learn from our Indigenous communities in this issue of climate change adaptation, from their wisdom and knowledge of the land that we live on. And I'm looking forward to seeing that some of that wisdom incorporated into our research program as we develop. Victoria faces a number of challenges in relation to climate change. We are in the most southerly part of the continent, so as the temperatures warm, our ecosystems aren't going to have much of a chance to move south. We're in a particular confluence of meteorological conditions that create these northerly wind funnel conditions across the state, which bring periodic high temperatures and high winds, which create a whole lot of challenges for our society in relation to management of fire and other threats associated with that. And our communities in general are going to find it quite difficult to adapt to some of the challenges, communities and industries, to climate change. On the other hand, I think we have a strong and diversified economy. We have a strong policy capability, decision-making capability within the state, probably some of Australia's leading thinkers in our academic institutions. So I think we're well placed in terms of providing the knowledge base in which to respond to climate change. So I'd just like to begin by acknowledging the contributions that a range of people have made to the establishment of this centre. It was initiated within state government. There are a couple of key people that were involved there, Fiona Williams and her team, John Hallahan and Jennifer Kane. Then there was a range of people from the research areas of the university that were involved in developing the agreements. Once the centre was established, the willingness of the people to join the board from the different universities, Lynn Crace from La Trobe, Rick Rausch, Dean of Land and Environment at Melbourne, Paul James from RMIT, and Dave Griggs from Monash University have all played a significant part in getting us to this point today. But the key members who really helped me get things up and going have been the implementation committee. That's Annabelle Duncan, Darren Grant from RMIT, Darren McAvoy from RMIT, who very willingly took on the role of deputy director, and Nigel Tapper from Monash University. So I'm very grateful to the efforts of those people in really helping get the program up and going. And in terms of today, I'd like to thank our executive officer, Doug Scobie, and Emma John, the executive assistant to the centre, who really put in a lot of effort to get the organisation right today and get the program on the road. So just a few housekeeping announcements if you need any help, Doug and Emma are up the back for transport, anything, other assistance that you need. The toilets are also just near the entrance as you walk in. There'll be tea and coffee available throughout the day. There's a coat cupboard available also if you need to store things. We have vegetarian and non-vegetarian meals available. And if you need to get some fresh air, please feel free to go out through the doors and take advantage of that. We're in a wonderful space here at the museum. It's a beautiful venue, and I think we need to make the most of it. And please switch off your mobile phones and so that we don't disturb the proceedings. So it's a pleasure now to... just one other thing to mention, that later today, for those who don't get enough of the talking during the day, there's a seminar on this evening at 5:30 at the School of Land and Environment's Dean's Lecture Series. Julian Cribb will be talking about a very appropriate topic, the coming famine, risks and solutions for global food security, and that's at the Elizabeth Murdoch Theatre at the University of Melbourne, just a short walk from here. So if you need help with that, then Doug will be able to give you assistance with that. So it's a pleasure now to introduce the Minister for Environment, the Honourable Gavin Jennings. And he began his parliamentary career in 1999, and he served through that time as Minister for Aged Care, Aboriginal Affairs, Community Services, and took up the portfolio of environment and climate change in August 2007. So I think Gavin's well placed to talk about a multi-institutional research effort, in that he took his Bachelor of Arts from Monash in 1978 and a Bachelor of Social Work from Melbourne in 1981. So he's spanning a number of the institutions in Victoria. He's had a long career both in the union movement and working in ministerial offices. And so I'd like to welcome you, Minister, to the stage to launch the forum today.
Rod, thanks for inviting me to the podium. I'd join you in paying my respects to the traditional owners of the land in which we gather, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, their elders past and present, and grateful to be in the company of a collaboration that recognises the cultural heritage of this land, and in terms of the lessons that can be learned in terms of the application of that culture in landscape management, as it particularly applies to many of the disciplines that we'll be teasing out and trying to respond to, trying to be maintain our resilience and our capability in dealing with the impacts on that landscape, the impacts on our economy, the impacts upon our lifestyle from climate change. And they're the basket of issues that have actually brought this great collaboration together. I'm particularly mindful for this banner actually says a little bit about the nature of this collaboration, the core missions writ large up the top, and in fact the partners are actually in relatively small script down the bottom, and I appreciate that. As Rod has indicated to you, yes, I'm a graduate of both the Monash and Melbourne universities. My brother and his wife went to La Trobe, and their daughter currently goes to RMIT. So in terms of the family connection to these great institutions, we have a great personal connection in our family. But we also understand the importance of that collaboration, so I emphasise it as actually something that's going to be the strength of the work that's being undertaken by the Centre. I'll come back and talk about that later on, but certainly the nature of the collaboration, the degree of engagement, the degree of bringing together key skills and contribution and capability is a feature of what Rod says, and it's certainly a feature of what I want to emphasise today. And I want to say that to be as upbeat as I can, given that there are a lot of good lines that are permeating my head today about climate change in a political context, and I'm not going to use them in your company. Because it's probably not the most positive and upbeat that I could be, and I intend to be so today. We in Victoria have been very mindful of the climate change challenge. We want to be very not only thoughtful in that space, but very determined to take action. We see the great need to bring our community with us, to bring the major players in our economy with us. And we continue to adopt that position undaunted. What that will mean in terms of what the work that we're underpinning here today is that it's pretty clear that the nature of adaptation will require our collective wit and wherewithal, our ability to be able, as close as we can, in real time to assess the consequences of climate change on our current life, so we can plan for the future scenarios in relation to climate change challenges, how we can assist our business, our communities, the households within our community, make wise decisions about how they can adapt their practices, adapt their lifestyle, plan for infrastructure and services that will be required to meet climate change scenarios. Certainly that's the reason why we're very keen to establish this centre. It's the reason why we'll be very keen to support the work. I certainly know that that's the spirit in which you come together. I had a very good, from my perspective, very constructive conversation with Rod late last year about the way in which the research program would be put together in a way that not only brings best science, best scientific analysis and that collaboration that I've been emphasising, but also finds way to engage appropriately in terms of community support, to community engagement, as much as we can to develop that capability in a real-time connectivity between what the analysis is actually telling us and, in fact, trying to provide that advice in a timely way so there can be an interactive and inclusive way in which that information can be used. Again, I emphasise as close as we possibly can in terms of real time in supporting communities, in terms of supporting industry, making wise decisions about the best way to account for the challenges that climate change is confronting. Now, I think that people in our community pretty much understand the dimensions of climate change. I think that whilst there might be some lack of focus and clarity in certain parts of the world in relation to this issue, I think people in Victoria are very, it's uppermost of our minds in relation to what we've seen, what we've collectively gone through. So the people in our community understand, I think we just have to need to remind them that after 13 years of drought, the major floods that occurred in 2008 in Gippsland didn't actually change the fact that we were still in drought. They can actually understand that there can be extreme events that actually occur, but in fact the long-term pattern is very clear. I think also that the coincidence in the 12 months between February 2009, February 2010, of course we had the tragic bushfires in our state, which people in our community are still recovering from, trying to do their best to stay strong and resilient, rebuild their lives. So that's very much uppermost of everybody's consciousness in Victoria. Yet we witnessed within a 12-month horizon, hailstorms that actually ripped through the metropolitan area, in particular golf ball-sized hailstones that actually occurred. Our community actually understands, I think, and we need to just remind them of the extreme situation and the long-term trends. I think it's a message that resonates pretty well with our community. Our community also is a very thoughtful, seems very thoughtful in comparative terms, it seems a very thoughtful and engaged community. And we think that there is a huge degree of community support for us to continue to take action, both in terms of what that means for adaptation, but what it means in terms of trying to drive a momentum for mitigation. And certainly we in Victoria will continue to maintain that emphasis, the coincidence of that approach. What the centre, I think, will be able to do in to try to actually distill those into a method. And that's what something that Rod and I actually talked about, something I actually want to reflect about, is the four priorities that have actually come bubbling through the consideration of establishing the centre. So in the first instance, in relation to in terms of the overall setting about where people are currently now, where they might project into the future, in relation to what adaptation challenges and opportunities might be, certainly scenario planning will be a major feature of the work in terms of mapping out potential scenarios in terms of what their impact upon the Victorian landscape, the Victorian community may be, and actually providing thoughtful prompts to our community and our major economic stakeholders, governments for that matter, to actually start thinking about the way in which we can account for those scenarios into the future. So that's the first element of the range basket of research focus. Next basket for the focus is in terms of the adaptation frameworks themselves, how they may apply from a regional basis and cumulatively up to a statewide basis in relation to how do you put these various elements together in terms of what you need to account for, what you actually need to be able to comprehensively cover the basket of issues that may relate to community, economic, transformation as relation to responding to adaptation issues. So that's the second element of the equation. How that actually then may relate to landscape and landscape management, there'll be a need to be a basket of issues and a research focus to actually see, well, what actions do we decisively take? What are the key strategies, what are the actions that we take on a landscape scale to address the pressures on land and biodiversity, water catchment, the integrity of water catchments, land, the appropriate way in which land use planning is acted upon and responded to, in terms of dealing with that large landscape land management issues. And the last, so that's the third, and the last area of research focus will be, in fact, an area that's a bit near and dear to my heart in relation to my other responsibility, which is innovation, the opportunity to straddle environment, climate change and innovation. This is actually a prism by which the work would be developed, particularly in relation to innovation, in relation to the energy and water sectors in particular, and how we can try to foster innovation, adapt to best practice, continually be searching about the way in which innovation can be driven in those sectors in particular. So I think, as you can see, I've read the prospectus in relation to the research program. I've actually digested it. I actually think that this is actually the four organising principles of great work that can be done by the centre. And I thank everybody who's been involved in bringing this together, because in fact not only is it a collaboration between the institutions that are identified here very modestly, but also an invitation for other institutions and communities to join. It's certainly something that the Victorian government has been very keen to partner with, and we see the collaboration between the government through DSE, Fiona and the team, in terms of actually trying to make that collaboration work, a very highly interactive process between what the government's hope for policy direction and research that actually steers that policy direction, through the scientific and academic rigour that's actually brought together through the research, and then ultimately the community engagement side of the equation, are the essential bits of that work coming together. And from our vantage point, we're very committed to drive that collaboration as hard and as broad as we can to make sure that we do not only good science, we do good community engagement, and as close as we can is something that I've emphasised before. From my vantage point, I would like us to be using information because of that way in which it's collected, the way in which it's actually shared, that in fact the information is used in a timely way. And that's a very important concept from my perspective in relation to the real-time application as much as we can of the wisdom of that insight. So certainly, so that's something that I'm hoping to be associated with. I'll be very keen observer, if not participant, in the work of the centre, and I'd be pretty keen to be very supportive of it. I'm glad that the minute that I stop, Quinton's going to take to the podium and actually remind us of our resilience building. I think that's a very nice thing to do. Today we should be collectively committed to resilience. That's what we might need today. So I think Quinton's going to provide us with a call to arms. And if now at the end of the day, Rod's already indicated to you that you might you might be attracted to listen to Julian's speech. But you also might be interested in coming and listening to me. I'm dealing with the Coastal Strategy and the Coastal Awards later today. And in many ways, the Coastal Awards are bringing together, because the Coastal Strategy in Victoria, all those great the community, the labour of love that is exercised by coastal boards and communities right along the coast of Victoria are living now, here and now, with many of the coincidence of the issues that I've been talking about as they impact upon our coast. And tonight we're actually talking about that and celebrating some achievements and celebrating people's commitments to continue to work on that. Now, I've got no idea where that is. It's somewhere in the metropolitan area. And if you're really interested, you can track me down. But I just let you know that whether it be the start of the day or the end of the day, I'll be on message today in terms of supporting the work that will be undertaken by the centre. So congratulations for the great quality of care that's been created in bringing the Senate together, and I look forward to the quality of the work. So thanks very much for the opportunity to share with that with you this morning.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask some representatives of the universities, the key universities involved, to speak briefly, but in the truncated beginning that I had, I would like to acknowledge that there's been a large number of people involved in development of the research program, but another crucial person that agreed to be involved and part of the team is the Chair of the Board, John Zillman. And I'd really like to thank you, John, for agreeing to take up that role. And he's already been a significant kind of mentor and played a significant leadership role in the board in helping us get our first round of projects through. So you'll hear more from John later in the day. As the Minister mentioned, there's been a whole range of people from the state government who've been actively involved through the research investment panel, and I'd particularly like to thank them for their contributions. So I'll first ask Peter Rathjen from the University of Melbourne, Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research, to just say a few words. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Rod, and thanks, Minister, for those kind words. One of the really impressive things about your government, I think, is the empathy that the ministers have for their portfolios and the depth of understanding that they display. I noticed that you had a written speech, and I noticed that you didn't use it, and you spoke off the top of your head with the knowledge and the passion you have for this issue. That actually means quite a lot. Gavin's quite an extraordinary person because I've seen him do exactly the same thing when talking about supercomputers in America and also when talking about metabolomics at the Bio21 Institute. So he's clearly fairly Catholic with his scientific interests. If you read the University of Melbourne strategic plan, there's a series of words there that we are trying to embrace as we work out what sort of institution it is that we want to be. And one of the really interesting ones is our aspiration to be an increasingly publicly spirited organisation. Now, within the research portfolio, we've spent some time interrogating that aspiration and wondering what it means to harness our research, to align our research with this mission of trying to be publicly spirited. One of the things we've started to do is to find ways of harnessing the great traditional disciplinary strength of the University of Melbourne and to align that with what we think are the major contemporary issues that are going to confront our society. We're trying to identify the big problems for the next 10 or 20 years and to work out how we can get our researchers to assort themselves or to organise themselves to help society to both understand and solve those issues. In part, we're doing that through structural changes. We've launched some research institutes, and there's one that's very relevant here today, the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute. I would like to just say that for us, this is part of what it is that we aspire to within the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, and to acknowledge the work of the inaugural director there, Ruth Fincher, who was actually very important in the early genesis of VICAR. We get the privilege of hosting this institute within the University of Melbourne, and we're very proud to do that. We think this is a very important exercise. We're also very proud that Rod Keenan, one of our staff, has been selected to direct the institute. But I need to make very clear that we're delighted to do this in partnership with three other fine universities. We're delighted to do this in partnership with the Victorian Government, which is such a strong supporter of tertiary sector and of research programs in this state. And we believe that it is those forms of partnerships that will enable us to deliver outcomes of true significance for Victoria. This is the way of the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. And now Professor Dane Alcorn from RMIT.
Minister, Rod, it's a delight to be here representing RMIT University, engaged in this centre. For RMIT University, whose outcomes are really to help the people, are directed at vocational and helping the community outcomes, this is a really very important area to be in. We're delighted that Darren McAvoy has taken such a role in the centre and commit to the outcomes as we move forward. It's a wonderful thing to be supported so strongly by the state government in climate change, as my colleague Peter has said, and to work in collaboration with the other universities, which I think going forward is an enormously important thing. The skills combined of so many academics on this will surely give us outcomes that we can use to our advantage. So once again, a delight. Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Professor Annabel Duncan from La Trobe University.
Minister, ladies and gentlemen, La Trobe also welcomes this initiative, not unsurprisingly, probably. It is a really a great initiative, I think. We support the ethos of the Vicar with a commitment to a translational research which will make a difference to the communities. Indeed, La Trobe's original mandate was actually to work with and for the communities in which it is situated, and with campuses all along the Murray-Darling Basin from Wodonga down to, up to Mildura, I guess. It covers a fairly broad community. And certainly those communities are going to be the most affected, I think, by climate change as we go forward. So it is actually a wonderful initiative from our point of view. La Trobe is also very committed to multidisciplinary research and to working with communities, as I say, which is why we have, for example, at our Bendigo campus, the Centre for Sustainable Regional Communities. It's why we've recently set up an Institute for Social and Environmental Sustainability. This is the approach that we want to take. We know of the importance of diversity in driving innovation, not only diversity of discipline areas, but also in mindset, which is why we like the idea of pulling together a number of institutions, all of whom have slightly different approaches and all of whom therefore can contribute to much broader and much more innovative projects than we might individually be able to do. Minister, thank you for the initiative of setting this up. We're delighted as a university to be a member, and we're looking forward to the opportunity to collaborate with the other universities, with government and with the Victorian communities to help inform policy and to make positive difference to the life of Victorians. Thank you very much.
And now Professor Nigel Tapper from Monash University.
Thanks very much, Rod. Minister, the Honourable Gavin Jennings and distinguished guests, Professor Edwina Cornish is unable to be here today and sends her apologies, so I'm saying a few words on her behalf. Monash is delighted to be associated with the establishment of this new Climate Change Adaptation Research Centre and to be collaborating in some of the extremely important initial projects and workshops that we'll learn a little bit more about later on in the day. It's becoming increasingly clear that Australia is on the front line of nations around the globe to be significantly impacted by climate change. And for a range of reasons, it can be argued that Victoria and Melbourne are amongst the most vulnerable of Australian states and capital cities to the vagaries of climate change. Along with the establishment of the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, the establishment of the Victorian Centre for Climate Change Adaptation Research is a very important step in the development of strategies to adapt to climate change. And I know from recent visits to China and to Europe in the last month or so that many overseas are well aware of the climate issues that are facing Australia and are looking for advice and for leadership from Australia in this regard. One clear example of this is the international interest in the innovative approaches to water and urban climate change that are being researched in a program called the Cities as Water Supply Catchments at Monash, and this has been recently funded by the Victorian State Government and the National Water Commission, the State Government in their science agenda. And it was remarkable to be travelling overseas recently and having the great amount of interest shown in some of the things that we're doing here in Australia. So I think that indeed Vicar could well become a showcase for excellence of Australian climate change adaptation research that could be marketed globally. In Monash's case, I believe that our well-established research strengths in climate, energy, transport, biodiversity, water and health, coordinated through our Sustainability Institute, can play an important part in the research life of the Victorian Centre, and we look forward to a long, productive and collaborative association with the new centre and with the partner universities. So thank you.
Thank you. And as the Minister mentioned, we are looking at opportunities to engage widely with other universities, and we've already had events where Ballarat University have taken the lead, involving Victoria University, and one of our projects will actually be led by Deakin University. So we are really aiming to engage the collective expertise that's available across Victorian institutions in this endeavour. So I understand the Minister has to leave us now. We thank you very much for your time. We know you're busy, and we look forward to continuing the communication and the positive spirit in which we set things up here. Thank you. Okay, so it's now again a pleasure to introduce Professor Quentin Grafton from the Australian National University. Quentin's the chair of the director of the Centre for Water Economics, Environment and Policy in the Crawford School of Environment, Economics and Governance at the ANU. He's originally an economist and a fisheries economist, but he's worked widely across a number of natural resource management issues, including water, more actively in the water area these days. And he undertook his PhD at the University of British Columbia, graduating about a year before me in 1992. But he's originally from New Zealand and holds degrees from Massey University and from Iowa State University in the US. He's currently the editor of the Australian Journal of Agricultural and Resource Economics, and has involvement as the UNESCO chair at the ANU. So I'm really pleased that he was able to take up the invitation today, and look forward to hearing your presentation. Thanks, Quentin.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Rod, and I'm very impressed with what's going on here in Victoria. I think Victoria's, I know Victoria's in the lead in terms of Australia, in terms of looking at climate adaptation. And this centre here that Professor Keenan's heading up is no doubt going to make an important contribution to the work that we need to have done here, not just in Victoria, but Australia-wide and internationally. So I have the honour, the pleasure to present an address today on the issues of climate change adaptation. And what I've tried to do is divide the presentation into two parts. So the first part is about systems and about resilience. Most of that is taken from the existing literature, okay? And then I'm going to hopefully give you some perspective about that. I know there's some people in this room who know a lot about systems and resilience, but I'm going to hopefully give you some perspective about that in terms of climate change adaptation, because they're not always put together, and I think they need to be. And so let's take a journey. So the first part is systems and resilience, and I'm going to talk about resilience thinking. It's been a lot of resilience thinking. It can go back to Buzz Holling back in the 1960s, and even before that. Systems thinking has been around at least as long as that, if not further back in the past, with the Meadows and various other people who worked on it, Forrester, etc. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about systems and networks. And I think systems as networks is important, because when you start to think about integrated approaches to climate adaptation, which I think this is what the centre is thinking about, certainly that's what Minister Jennings is talking about, then you need to think, I think, in network structures, in the sense of what are the linkages, how they go back and forth from the key nodes, whether they're communities or whether they're industries or whether they're something else. And then I'm going to come up with a heuristic. So this heuristic is simply a sort of a summary of the ideas that are out there in the literature and systems and resilience thinking. And that's the first part. And so I think it's important just to start off and have a look at what people say and then think about how that impacts on how we think. And so this is a quote back from February this year, and it's quoting Jaime Caldeana, who's now at the International Bank of Settlements, and he's just talking about the global financial crisis. Okay, so this is a very smart man who thinks a lot about the finance. He's a banker from Spain, And he's just basically emphasising here, at the time where we thought things were the most able to continue on, in fact, it was the most riskiest time, as history has pointed out to us. So that's just an issue about resilience. So in other words, there's a system in place, this global financial system. We now know that there are major fragilities in that system, and still are. And that quote is simply just there illustrating that we can get system shifts quite rapidly, actually very rapidly, and that we need to think about resilience to avoid those sorts of unexpected and unpleasant sorts of shocks. So here's a quote from somebody entirely different, Leo Tolstoy, and this is from War and Peace, but why I'm talking about quoting Tolstoy, because it's a nice little quote. I won't read it out, you can read it yourselves. But basically it's this issue about how we try to simplify life, how to simplify the challenges and problems that we face. And so what that's saying is that there's a characteristic of us to try and find that one particular issue. Oh, that must be the reason why we have the global financial crisis, for example. Oh, it was the securitization. Oh, it was the change in the Fed rate. Oh, it was, it wasn't one thing. It was a multitude of things. And in a systems way of thinking, we need to think that there are a variety of causes. And more importantly than that, there are important feedbacks. So if we go down this route and say, well, here is the cause, one cause, then we're not systems thinking. Okay, we need to think, well, is that the case? Or is there other connections and other feedbacks that we need to think through? So those are sort of the two ways of thinking. And I'll go through a little bit more detail about the mistaken orthodoxy with lack of systems thinking and a lack of resilience thinking. And so just here's the sort of mistaken orthodoxy. So the issue here is markets versus regulation. Oh, it's got to be markets or it's got to be regulation. Well, no, it's not either or. We can actually have both. Okay, effective regulation is important, but markets can also deliver for us as well. Economy versus the environment. Well, no. The economy delivers lots of good things for us and a whole range of things, and the economy does, in fact, include the environment. So it's not either or. And the current state, well, that's a tendency for all of us to think in the current state of the world. That's also true of our politicians and decision makers. But the issue here is the current state the only state that matters? And clearly not. It's the trajectories that matter as well. So you could go back 30-odd years to Nauru, for example, or we could go back to 2000 and with the dot-com crash before these events actually take place. We seem to be in a good state of the world, but actually the trajectory is not a good trajectory, and we end up in a very unpleasant state. And I would argue in a world situation, that's the current state right now. Okay, we are, relatively speaking, compared in a historical sense, we are doing very well compared to where we were 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago in a whole range of measures of health indicators, living standards, et cetera, et cetera. But I would argue the trajectory is not a healthy trajectory, and certainly that's true in many parts of the world. So that means we need to do something different. And then here's another sort of mistaken orthodoxy. Things that worked well in the past, well, they're bound to work well in the future. And that may well be the case. It may well be the case, but let's not assume that it's the case. And I would argue that management of the global financial crisis, for example, is indicative of where those sorts of rules that have worked well in the past may not work so well in the future. And then just the linear thinking. We see it all the time. You know, we just look at projections in terms of even population. Now, populations don't just always go up at a particular trend. There are things that go on along the way. It's true for a whole range of phenomena. We can't just use linear thinking. We have to understand what's going on behind that when we think in a future context. So now I'm going to try and put the two things together. There's systems and there's resilience thinking. They're not unrelated. They're actually very much connected to each other. And I think resilience is really part of systems thinking, although some people may not agree with me with that point. But I'm going to take you this point here. So what do we mean by a system? Well, a system is just simply a mental device of how we understand the world around us. We create that. So we have to create some boundaries about how we understand, whether it's a system, whether it's the city of Melbourne. The city of Melbourne doesn't exist by itself. It's connected to the rest of Victoria, the rest of Australia, the entire world. But we can think of it as a system in that context, for example. And so here's a system, system state A, So it's in some particular state. Maybe it's a desirable state. Most at the moment, we consider most of the states that we're in at the moment, maybe sorts of things that we want to continue. Then we have another state, System B, which may be a less desirable state. And there's a potential, and this is where the thresholds come, there's a potential to cross from one state of the world to another state of the world. And that can happen surprisingly quickly. And so resilient systems thinking is to say, well, let's understand the system. What are the key drivers in the system? What are the key variables in the system? Understand that there may well be a lack of resilience that will shift us from one state to another, okay, an undesirable state, for example, system B, and try to understand that threshold and manage how we manage our key drivers, I suppose, in terms of ensuring that we don't cross that threshold. In some cases, we are going to cross a threshold, in which case we need to prepare for that threshold and do transformational change that takes us into not just a fixed state system B, but maybe a system C that's more desirable than system B. So here's just some definitions to understand that there's lots of people who've thought about this in terms of resilience. This is a Holling definition of resilience that's used by Australia 21. And it's basically, in summary, the greater the shock removed from the current state, the more resilience. So if it takes a greater shock to move us from a current state, then it's considered to be more resilient. And how can we apply that? Well, we can apply that context in the case of, let's say, the northern cod fishery in Canada. I use it as an example because it's one of the biggest collapses of any fishery of the last century. And this is the collapse you can see here. Okay, these are in millions of tons of fish, and you can see going down in the, because of overfishing to the mid-70s, then growing because of reduced fishing, and then various changes, but primarily overfishing, and the stock collapses in 1992. And there's no more harvesting to speak of, and it hasn't changed. Okay, there's been a system shift. Okay, so since 1992, there are essentially no cod to speak of in Atlantic Canada. So that's what actually happened, and it just keeps on going. Okay, over here to 2010. And then here's a model in terms of what could have happened if we'd done something different. So what we're talking about here is the sorts of actions that we could do to provide resilience to the system, the notion of Holling resilience. And it's a model context. We don't know what would have happened, but the model context suggests here that if we had a better harvesting rule in terms of lower harvest, but more importantly than that, in terms of a marine reserve, in the sense of a no-take zone, that we wouldn't have crossed whatever that threshold is. There's clearly some threshold around here that was clearly crossed. So that just resilience thinking suggesting what are the key drivers or actions that we can do, which can then potentially make a difference in terms of outcomes. So PIM resilience is a related concept. Okay, Holling talks about it in a system context. This is really in a system context, of course, but it's about return to some previous state, some neighborhood of some previous state. So a shock happens, and then the system goes back, still within its overall boundaries, but it goes back to some neighborhood of its previous state. That's a notion called PIM resilience. They obviously are connected. Holling and PIM resilience are connected, but it's important because it provides also a measure of how close you are to thresholds. That's not a general rule, but it's certainly indicative of work that's been done, that if you tend to bounce back quickly, okay, that's an indication that you are some distance away from some thresholds. If it's very, very slow recoveries, then that indicates that you may be approaching some threshold points. So it's certainly an interesting way of applying it. And then this is applied in the context of the cod fishery, northern cod fishery, and you can see that a reserve, a no-take area, provides some PIM resilience in the sense that you can provide extra fish because of a shock that takes place. You've got a reserve of fish, a buffer stock that provides a flow of fish available for harvesting. So that provides benefits to the fishers. It also provides benefits to the fishery as well. So there's in terms of the stocks. So here's a case of PIM resilience that you can implement again through particular policy actions. And then there's another definition which is connected to the previous ones. And I give this definition because it is by a couple of economists, not me, Greg Kurtzler and Mark Harris, both now at the University of Sydney, and that it's talking about the expected time to reach this threshold point. So if you go back to where that previous diagram with the system A and system B, with this, we don't really know exactly where that threshold is in many cases, but an expected time to cross that threshold. And so you can think about, you can change this expected time. It's not fixed. Okay, there may be policy actions that you can do to change that. Or if you are moving to that threshold, then you can say, can we do transformational change that takes us instead of to a system B to system C, where system C is more desirable than system B. So I'm just going to close up in terms of this first part of the lecture to try and think about networks as, or systems as networks. So I should say rather than networks as systems, so we can do it both ways. And so this is just indicating how you can think about network structures. So what we have here are dots, okay? These are particular points that could be anything. It depends what the network structure it is. It could be agents trading amongst themselves. It could be cities. It could be a whole range of different it could be farms in a particular location. And these linkages between them represent how they connect to each other. And they're two-way or one-way linkages. And how these linkages are established, so this is obviously much more interlinked, this one on the right, than this one on the left, has implications for system behavior. Okay? So what I mean by that is how they are linked makes a difference in terms of when things happen, like a shock, for example. So a shock can get propagated potentially much more in a particular system like this than a system like this. Why that's useful for climate adaptation, because it helps us think in that context of how communities, cities, even individuals can link across a particular landscape, and it suggests where there may be potential points of action as well. Okay, and this has been done in the context of infrastructure in terms of electricity infrastructure to look at critical points, but it can be used widely. Network structures can be applied in all sorts of contexts. Implied by a colleague of mine, Prasanna Guy. It's just come out in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And what they looked at is bank collapse. So they've taken the connection issue. And they've got these can always be a bit awkward to read, the 3XE type diagram. But what it's saying here is a connectivity across the banks. Okay. So if you look at this, it's saying that if you have a low capital buffer, okay, so let's say 1 or 2%, which is what we've had in the past internationally, and you have high connectivity, 15 to 20, then you're asking for trouble in terms of expected defaults. Okay, so you can still have high connectivity, provided you have high capital buffers, and still not have that problem. So in other words, you can work in two dimensions. You can work on the connectivity dimension, or you can work on the capital buffer dimension, or you can work on both simultaneously. I mention this because right now there's a discussion about connectivity in terms of a tax. So banks would be taxed on the basis of connectivity to affect the defaults. But you don't have to do it on the connectivity. I'm not suggesting it should be done, but it could be done. You can adjust it on the capital buffers. Why this is useful, it's a network structure. It's a network structure that's trying to understand how we get collapse, in this case default, in a banking sector structure. We can apply that in a whole various structures using networks. That's why I think it's a useful thing to think about. And that's the sort of thing we should be thinking about in terms of climate adaptation. So here's a heuristic. This is just simply a set of ideas that I'm summarizing. They're not my ideas, though I share those ideas. They're ideas that have come collectively from various people in the literature. Okay, so this is a collective wisdom here. I just put them in a framework. So phenomena. Okay, so actions will have unexpected consequences. I suppose that's a statement of the obvious. but it's worth emphasizing simply because if we have a network structure in mind of how systems operate, we can think through, well, we do this, do X, Y, Z, and W will happen. Rather than the linear thinking, we do X, just one thing will happen. I have to think in an integrated way. Network structures give us an opportunity to think in that way. It gives us a structure, a modeling structure to do about it, to do that. Multiple leaders need to ensure success in different states of the world. Having a conversation with someone from DSC, I can't remember his name, is it Michael, I think, and Adriana from MIT, talking about uncertainty. The greater the uncertainty we have in the world, the more levers we want to have at our disposal. Doesn't mean that we're going to use all the levers, but we want to have more levers at our disposal. So if we restrict ourselves to just one lever in a very uncertain state of the world, we're asking for big time trouble. Okay, so we can think of that. I'm not picking any particular location, okay? But you can think of that in terms of water management. Okay, think of the case of, well, we've got climate change. Okay, we don't have sufficient water coming into our catchments. Okay, how do we resolve that? Well, we go ahead and build a multi-billion dollar desalination plant. That is a one approach that may not be the appropriate approach, and it leads you down a particular route. Okay, and if with greater uncertainty, you may want to have multiple options available to you as you go down that route, and as information is provided to you. So structures, connections matter. They clearly do matter, and we can model it, we can think about that. And if we don't, then we've got asking for big trouble when it comes to climate adaptation. So here's the policy part. I believe Vic is not just about research, it's about policy, it's about making a difference, and that's why I think it's a very important center. We've got to understand what are the critical variables. So just saying that everything's networked and connected is not going to take us very far, okay? Okay, the world's a complicated world, doesn't take us very far. So we have to do some research. That's what researchers will find. What are the critical variables that will affect multiple components of the system? Okay, so we try and understand that. And there's certain things that I think we can do to understand what those critical variables are. We need to understand current actions have long-term consequences. Again, not trying to be critical of any particular government decision, but for example, you build a desalination plant, that is a current action that will have long-term consequences. It lasts decades. You build a power plant today, it has consequences in the long run. And then, of course, causes and effects come in loops. And that's very much systems thinking. And so that's the first part of the lecture, just hopefully not too quickly, just to give you a sense that there's a lot of rich insights available from systems thinking, going back decades, and from resilience thinking, also going back decades, but also in the last few years as well. So I think we can draw upon that literature, those insights, and it's still ongoing. They don't have the last word, so to speak. There's a lot more we need to know, but we can draw on those insights when we apply it into the context of climate adaptation, which is what I'm arguing we should be doing. So the second part of my lecture is now to be more focused on climate adaptation. And so I've got a few things to go through. I'm going to try and say, well, we can have a systems perspective in climate adaptation as well. Okay, we can think about risk, and here's risk is going to become very important in terms of climate change. And then I'm going to talk about, in some sense, those policy levers. How do we can think about those policy levers and think about the planning processes and how we can implement that. And so that's where I'm heading. And the very end is, again, some sort of summary, my thinking more than anyone else's, in terms of the sort of heuristic that we can think about and apply. And one of the important things to keep in mind when we think about climate adaptation, it has actually have to be localized, because landscapes differ. Even in a state as Victoria, there'll be very substantial differences depending on, and that was mentioned by Annabelle, I believe, in terms of the impact on this state. And so we certainly have to keep in mind that there's no sort of formula to follow necessarily, but there's certainly guidance that we can draw upon. So this is not my diagram. It's from Chapin et al. It's a book that came out looking at social ecological systems. It just came out last year. It's kind of nice. So what all they're trying to illustrate, this is actually a forestry system that's being illustrated, which Professor Keenan knows all about, and I know very little. But this is basically saying that there's a whole range of things that we need to think through on the ecological side, the social side, and that we need to integrate the two things together to get proper understanding. One of the things that this is emphasizing, that there are slow variables and there are fast variables in the terms of how systems can change. It's those critical variables, so to speak. The slow variables tend to be stock variables. So they don't change immediately or change rapidly, but the flow variables, okay, tend to change, we can change quite rapidly. Okay, so we need to understand the stocks and flows and see the impacts between the two and then how that happens over time and the sort of the feedback loop. So it's a way of saying we can take systems thinking, a systems perspective, and we can apply it in a broad sense, which is what Chapin et al. Have done here as an illustration. So then when we start to do that, we say, okay, we've got a system framework or perspective. How do we start to make decisions? How do we put money into projects? How do we make it a determination of where we should put our efforts? Those are the sort of the key questions that policymakers face, and I don't think researchers necessarily have the answers for them. But there are ways of thinking that I think that are helpful. So this is not my approach. This just comes out of the risk literature. But it tries to illustrate the fact that there may well be relationships between probability of events and the consequences of those events. And that's what this blue line, R1, is trying to illustrate, is you could take a case where you have high consequences but low probability, maybe equivalent to a low consequence and a high probability. Okay, it's suggesting that there's some similarities between those two quite different ends of the spectrum. All this is illustrating is that with climate change, we will shift from an R1 state of the world to an R2 state of the world. And that has implications. So we have, even if the probability remains the same, okay, the probability of an event remains the same, maybe a flood. So the probability of floods may be the same, but of course the probability could change, but the consequences may be bigger. Okay, so the flood event may even be a larger magnitude. Or we can think of the probability, so the consequence goes up. Or you can think of here the probability is high, doesn't change, but there's a consequence changes. So it's by itself the diagram doesn't help us very much, but it gives us a way of thinking about what are the probabilities of events. So in other words, we're in an uncertain state of the world, and what are the consequences of those events? And then once we start in those frameworks, then we can think of what are the high magnitude events, what are the sorts of things that are going to cause the greatest amounts of vulnerability. And then once we do that, we can start to think about a process that we can start to work through as, let's say, policymakers and researchers. So I've adapted this from work that's gone on in the climate adaptation literature, and I've added various things to it. So most of you who are aware of climate adaptation work, which would be just about everyone in this room, there's this notion that you've got climate change exposure. Okay, so that's what's actually going to happen, which is going to result in physical processes. The sensitivities, okay, which will determine, so if there's a change in rainfall, the sensitivities will be determined, for example, whether you're an irrigation community. You'll be much more sensitive to reductions in rainfall and inflows if you're an irrigation community than if you're not, given the same amount of exposure. So that feeds into potential impacts associated with climate change. And then the issue that, to me, that's really important is this right-hand side of the diagram, is there's two things that I think we have to think through. One is the bioadaptation capacity. I call it adaptation capacity. The literature calls it adaptive capacity, but I don't like that term because it's about adaptation. We're talking about climate change adaptation. Adaptive capacity can get confused with adaptive management. They're different things. So this capacity is really not just about the biophysical. It's really a lot about the social, the economic aspects. And so you can think of, and as people have thought of this, this suggests that there are capital stocks. There's a natural, physical, human, financial, and social that influence or help to determine adaptation capacity. Why we can think in a systems context with stocks, because stocks, of course, are these slow variables, but they're not given for all time. We can influence stocks by investment and disinvestment. So we can invest in physical, human, financial, and social capital. Okay, we can also influence natural capital as well. We can influence those, which will then influence our capacity. Then the capacity, just because we have good adaptation capacity, doesn't necessarily mean we have good adaptive responses. Keep this in mind, because you can have high adaptation capacity, so you, let's say, have high financial resources, but you could then use those financial resources for maladaptation. So your responses could end up being the wrong sort of responses. You could end up using your resources, your capacity, so to speak, to actually reinforce a system that may actually need to change in the sense that it needs to adapt to climate change. So that's why I've made these two things quite separate. Good adaptation capacity does not necessarily mean good adaptation responses. They're not the same thing. And then how do we improve upon them? Well, I would argue resilience and systems thinking is really important to think about what those sensitivities are. Planning processes, and I'll talk about that in more detail, and adaptive management. I won't talk about that because a lot of people know about adaptive management, okay, but I'm talking about active adaptive management. Okay, that will give some insights in terms of what the system is into those uncertainties, and then respond in a flexible way as we get realizations of the states of nature. So this is a way of thinking, I think, about how we can intervene in terms of the in terms of stocks, in terms of how we approach our planning, and in terms of what actually happens. So I would argue that if you take this approach, and I don't know whether the analogy is perfectly suitable, but I'll give it to you anyway. I would argue that if we think in a resilience context, it's about building, you know, a better house, so to speak, before the storm arrives. So, you know, we fix the walls up, we have good windows, etc. And so that's resilience. It's getting a system in place that can deal with those shocks as they arrive, the unexpected shocks, the unforeseen circumstances that arise. I would argue that active adaptive management is a process to deal with as the storm hits. Okay, so the storm hits, what do? Well, we fix the windows. Okay, the windows break, the hail, whatever it might be. We're able to fix those problems as they arise, and we do so quickly and efficiently. But you could also think of, in another context, suppose the house is in the wrong place. Okay, so adaptation in an active adaptive management sense is, yeah, it's not just about fixing windows, but maybe the house is in the wrong place. So maybe we'll need a big truck at some point to pick that house up, put it on the truck, and move it someplace else, which I would call transformational change. So rather than incremental adaptation, we might want to sort of have a transformational shift in terms of moving that house. So if you think of it, the resilience is the house, building the better house before the storm. Active adaptive management, at least in an incremental adaptation change, is about fixing the windows as they break. And perhaps, potentially, the transformational change is actually moving that house to another location where the storm front may not be so problematic. And so if you think in those contexts, then you can think about what are the vulnerability drivers. So if we go back here, here's the vulnerabilities. Okay. So there's various drivers generating the vulnerabilities. And you can think on the other side is the risk, because we don't know what's going to happen, so we have to do some risk assessment and manage that risk. And then In the middle here is that adaptation capacity. Okay, so how do we affect those capital stocks to actually make an impact in terms of what we can and cannot do in terms of the shocks that may arise with climate change? And the key issue with climate change is not only that it's change, but that change is unexpected. Okay, so if we knew exactly what was going to happen for the next 100 years on all our landscapes, that would be difficult, but I would say that's a different problem than the problem that we will actually face, because we'll have some idea. You know, we know temperature is going to change in a reasonable, you know, relative certainty, at least over larger landscapes. We will have much less certainty about inflows in particular catchments on a localized level. So as uncertainty increases, then we need to move more to the risk focus. More certainty, we can more focus over on the vulnerability. And then in each case, we've got the adaptation capacity. So how do we reduce vulnerabilities? Well, there's a number of things we can do. This is not an exhaustive list. We can promote resilience. That's the sort of thing that I was talking about earlier, about building the better house before the storm arises. Adaptation capacity, we want to build that up, and that can be done in a number of different ways. We want to improve the effectiveness of our responses. And in that diagram, I suggest that active adaptive management is a not the only way, but it's a very effective way of actually improving those adaptation responses. And then last on my list, though that's not a exhaustive list, is to improve the adaptation planning processes. And I would argue right now, not just in Victoria, but Australia-wide, you know, I would be arguing that we want to be thinking in this context, the resilience, because I think some of our systems are not resilient, so we definitely need resilience thinking, okay, as change occurs. And that's this part is happening right now, okay? So there's various initiatives across the country in terms of adaptation planning processes, and hopefully, at least on those 1 or 4, we're making some movement. And so here's a way of thinking about vulnerability and adaptation that I've adapted. So you can put in the context of where we're at. You can think of this as a planning process almost with the communities. So what communities are after, what do they want, what are the scenarios, as the Janix talked about. What can happen, how could it happen? So we need to sort of think about, model those sorts of things and analyze them, and then evaluate the risk associated with those vulnerabilities. And then obviously at some point or other, it's not just research, it's about understanding what the responses should be, which of course is feeding into stakeholder collaboration all along the way, and then simulate review and feedback. So that's an approach that we can think through, a mechanism or framework to help us in terms of climate adaptation. And then in climate risk management, I would argue that there's 3 things that we can do as well. So we've got to incorporate assessment of current and future vulnerabilities, and that framework I've just gone through quickly expresses a way that we could do that. And 2, and that's also in that framework, we've got to engage with stakeholders. There is a tendency to talk about climate adaptation as a top-down process, and there may well be required top-down processes in terms of planning processes, for example. But if it's just top-down, we're going to miss important aspects of climate adaptation and things that we'll probably end up doing incorrectly. So we've got to engage stakeholders in the process and then model different states of the world and then come up with different strategies. So in other words, it's about forward-looking, thinking about different states of the world, thinking how we can come up with different actions and what those actions may have, what impact of those actions on our future. And so one way we can think about that is do a risk and simulation approach. So what I'm suggesting in here is that when you at the Department of Sustainability and Environment in Victoria or wherever you might be in Australia or in the world, you don't really know what's going to happen, okay? But you might have some idea. There'll be some boundaries. So you might have a boundary in terms of the impacts might be between 0, there may not actually be any impacts that you could think of, so it's a 0 number here, or it could be up to, let's say, $10 million. Okay? You might have a best guess of $2 million, and then you might think that it's a triangular distribution, so you've got a 90% confidence interval over that area of where it might be. Now, you're not fixed according to that particular distribution, but you'd have multiple sets of distributions, you'd have ways of thinking about this, and then as you get more information, you may be able to say, well, we got it wrong, you know, it's not 10, it could be 20, it could be 40, it could be 50, we misread what was going on, and then you can then use that as a device to think about, well, what are the critical things that we need to be thinking about, okay, what are the big issues that we need to be dealing with first in terms of that? In terms of the issues associated with the risk associated with climate change. This is just an approach that we can use. There's an approach used in fisheries. Professor Keenan talked about my work in fisheries. There's an approach called management strategy evaluation that provides a framework for thinking about risk and thinking about policy actions. It doesn't provide you with a way of hiding from uncertainty, but it provides you a way of embracing that uncertainty to try and actually come up with better decision making. And then the other question that's raised, it's been raised to me by policymakers, and I think raised to me because I'm an economist, is the question is, well, when do we act? Okay, so. The point I would emphasize here is that, yes, we need to act right now in terms of planning processes, but we don't necessarily need to act right now in terms of where we invest. Okay? In other words, acting too soon could be inappropriate, but there are certain things that may well be advantageous regardless of what happens in the world. So this is just a 4-dimensional box that tries to think that through. And climate adaptation is a device that moves us in a direction from the, let's say, the left to the right. So what is this four square box, I should say, it's not 4 dimensions. So on the vertical axis, we've got a present gain and a present loss. So if it's above this horizontal line across, then we're into a present loss. It's beneath it, then we're into a present gain. If you take this vertical line, which starts is here at zero, if we're to the left, we're in a future loss. But if we're to the right, we're in a future gain. So what's the present? What's the future? Well, maybe the present's the next 3 to 5 years. Maybe the future's beyond that for the next 25, 50 years. And there may well be a set of actions, and I would argue that there are a set of actions that are, in fact, no regrets actions. So they not only give us wins today in terms of higher gains in the present, they give us higher gains into the future. They may not necessarily be implemented because although this is a societal gain, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's a winner. Okay, and so we have to understand the connections, the networks, I suppose, the political economy of it. Obviously, we don't want to be in this box, the lose-lose box, but sometimes we are. And I would see climate adaptation as shifting us into this direction. And it gives us some guidance of how we can shift, let's say, win-loss into win-win, maybe loss-win into win-win as well. So there may be actions that we can do that can actually shift us over into that dimension, which gives us some insight in terms of the intertemporal nature of where we make our decisions. So I'm going to conclude now. I've got a couple of minutes left by looking at another heuristic. So keep in mind, these are not a hard and fast rules. They're just guides to how we can think about climate adaptation. And so the first thing is I want to talk about is processes. So this gets back to the house analogy. There are ex-ante measures, so what I mean by ex-ante is that we start to do them now before we have the realizations in terms of climate change that support resilience of biophysical and socioeconomic systems. So there are things that we can do right now that can promote resilience, regardless of whether we have climate change or not, but those sorts of actions will give us an ability to, or a buffer, if you want to think of it in those terms, to be able to deal with those shocks in a more effective way. We can do that right now, if we wish to. Okay. So that's the processes. Institutionalized planning process and actively include stakeholders. That's actually taking place right now. Obviously, we need more, and it can be better. And there are examples of Boston versus London of how you've done processes of including stakeholders and processes where you haven't had stakeholders actively involved. And not surprisingly, if you don't have the stakeholders actively involved, you're not going to get the buy-in. If you don't get the buy-in, then you're not likely to get the outcomes that you may wish to get. So I clearly think it's important that it can and initially will be more expensive to exclude stakeholders. It increases your cost, it increases the time processes. But we're talking about long-term processes here. So I think that the time taken to include stakeholders is well worth it. Okay, it's not like a meteorite's going to hit tomorrow. Okay, these are long-term processes and changes, so we can and should include stakeholders in those processes. And then adopt a risk-based management frameworks and decision frameworks. So when we make decisions, we want to have safety margins. Okay, so we want to be able to ensure that if we got it wrong in the current state of knowledge, then we've got some buffer, some safety margin. You know, there are obvious things like you don't build a house right now next to the beach. I mean, that's an obvious thing that you wouldn't be doing. There's no safety margin there, is there, in terms of sea level rise? Okay, so but that is, there may maybe less obvious approaches that we can think through as well. And then the actions, which I suppose is the more important aspect of it, but they're equally connected. We've got to promote ex post management. All I mean by ex post is that as we get more information, as we incur climate change, it's not just the climate variability, as we find that there are trends that are taking place, and we can explain those trends, then we want to have adaptive management. And that means that we respond flexibly to the change that's taking place, and speedy response to shocks. And then this get back to that intertemporal box that I came up with. We want win-win approaches. Go for the win-wins first. That doesn't mean we can't go for the other boxes as well, but if we can go for those sets of actions that truly are win-win, then I think we're at the head of the game. And then I would argue the last point, and I think it's the point I'm going to emphasise because it's an important one that we tend to forget about. We've got to adopt, I think, reversible or flexible management, which fits into this notion of adaptive management up here. But we've got to be aware of maladaptation. Okay, now the reason I emphasise this, okay, is because there's now $30 billion available for climate adaptation in the world. Okay, and so that money is going to be spent, okay, in the developing countries. And I think there's a real possibility, or probably a probability, that a good portion of that money will be misspent. Why? Because how do you spend $30 billion on communities? Well, you probably can't spend $30 billion on communities, but you can spend $30 billion on infrastructure quite easily. And if we build the infrastructure without doing the planning processes, we'll end up with maladaptation. We'll end up subsidies for water efficiency, for example, that commit communities to particular locations without giving them the flexibility of adaptation to the sorts of changes that may be taking place, for example. So those are the sorts of things that we need to think through. And I think we need to be absolutely aware of it in the international context and also in the national context here as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Quentin. I think you've given us an excellent journey through some of the key sort of conceptual underpinnings of adaptation. And happy now, I think, to take a few questions.
Absolutely.
A few minutes before we break point into Chris.
I've got one question, because your talk seems to make serious assumptions. I just want to...
Sure, go ahead.
One assumption you made in the latter part of the talk is at some point we'll be able to tell the difference between climate change and climate variability when we're experiencing it. Another one is that climate change, in terms of adaptation, is pretty well only a long-term problem, not a problem of the here and now. Another one that seemed to be through the talk is the current state is desirable.
Okay.
And
okay, so let me just start writing that, because you've got several points, so my brain's not good enough to take all that in. Okay, so...
Okay, so one assumption is to tell the difference between climate change and climate variability.
Yep.
Another one, that climate change adaptation is primarily a long-term problem. Another one, because the current system state tends to be desirable.
Yep.
And the final one is we can never adequately define the system. If they're assumptions, I actually don't hold for them.
Okay. Okay, first one, climate variability versus climate change. Well, I believe that we can. There are ways we can do that. Whether we can do it at this point in time, we can debate that. It's outside of my realm of expertise. I'm not a climate change scientist. But certainly CSIRO has made that determination. Bureau of Meteorology has made that determination. And it's not just based on GCM-type models. It's also based on key drivers. So I can't answer the question to your satisfaction, no doubt. But I think that there are ways that we can, over time, be able to make determinations. Climate variability happens, of course. Climate change is about trends as well, and looking at what's happening in terms of anthropogenic GHG emissions. So yes, I believe we can. The question is in what context and when, and that's obviously a detailed question. Second issue is climate change is about long-term issues. Well, clearly it's about long-term issues because we've only started to feel, if we are talking about climate change and not just climate variability, we're only just starting to feel it right now. If it's climate variability, we've got 12 years of drought, depending where you want to pick that particular period of time in terms of Victoria, the Southern Murray-Darling Basin, or we can think about longer periods as well. It doesn't really matter in some context. All we're talking about here is to say that there's change taking place. How do you manage that change? So if it's a variability change in the sense it's a 50-year cycle change, or whether it's actually a long-term change that'll change forever, does it really make much difference in terms of our planning processes? Probably not, okay, because we should still be planning for it anyway. So, for example, if we take the Murray-Darling Basin, should we have built the storages that we did? Should we have made the investments we made? Should we have made the allocations in terms of water entitlements that we did in that period, 1950 up to the 1980s, if we had a resilience systems way of thinking? And I would say probably not, because we would have thought of it in a different context. So does that answer the question? Maybe it doesn't.
It's a long-term problem and need long-term
Well, there again, but I don't want to, I'm not putting you in that camp, but be careful about this, okay? Be very careful about the maladaptation. There's going to be pressure from people to spend money and spend money now, okay? Now, we can spend money. We can easily spend money. It's been shown the last few months how we can spend money quickly. The question is, can we spend that money in an effective way? And I would argue, if you want to talk about climate change now, you can provide information. So that's certainly been happening in terms of where we'd expect sea level rises to, for example.
I'm not saying anything about spending money.
I'm not saying they're not short-term things, and I can give you some suggestions that we can do short-term. But I'm also arguing that it's not just saying that we have the answers today, because I suspect that you, nor I, nor anyone in this room have all the answers. So if you're in an uncertain world, okay, you don't want to spend all your chips on one thing. You want to allocate your resources over different options, learn from that, and then move from there. That's what I think is active adaptive management. So I don't think we're necessarily at odds on that. And then the fourth point was, do we have an adequate representation of the systems or the systems that we're talking about? Well, clearly the answer is no, we don't, okay? But is it helpful to us to have a systems approach to think about it? And I would argue, yes, it is helpful, okay? So it doesn't mean that we just say that that's the only model of the world, but it's a way of framing the problem, framing an understanding, and then it gives us an opportunity to simulate, to think about what are the potential feedbacks, loops, the drivers, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's helpful. It's much more helpful than pontificating without having evidence, without thinking about in a framework that allows us to debate those issues. So I agree with you. We'll never have a good handle on a system or systems, but I think systems thinking and building those sorts of approaches is appropriate and has been proved successful over many decades. Yeah.
That you might be confronted by system shifts because you don't have, and you will never have, perfect information, and then thinking about how to be resilient with the acceptance that you actually are going to be confronted by a rather nasty rapid shift at some stage.
I don't think we're in disagreement. I've worked in the fisheries context where you get rapid shifts. It choose an insect population, fisheries population, far more than in the terrestrial, generally terrestrial environments. And I think that approach of modeling, thinking, systems thinking, resilience in terms of marine reserves and no-take areas is very helpful in those contexts. So I think you can apply them in this context as well in climate adaptation. Is it the only way to go? No, I don't think so, but it's a framework for our thinking. So maybe we'll disagree, but I think I stand by what I've said, and I think there's a lot of evidence to back up what I've said.
Is there another question?
I'll just carry on the same discussion. Yeah. One of the things which seems to come through in your talk was also an assumption that we would have increasing and improving knowledge on things. And we may have more information. In fact, all it's an explosion of information. Mm.
I think it's how you use that information. So if I look at the context of the fisheries, for example, there's been lots of money spent on fisheries research over many decades, and you get a lot more fine-tuned information on particular aspects. Single species management is a context where you get lots of fine, detailed information, but you wouldn't get information on how fish are migrating, for example. So I would argue that you have to be clever in terms of how you make your investments, in terms of your collection of your information. And so you don't just want narrow aspects of the system, but you want a broader context of what's going on and how fish move, for example, in the fisheries context, but you know, a range of things in the terrestrial environment. So then it needs to feed into processes, okay, where that information is used in an effective way. So if it's used in a way that it's just a group of scientists taking that information and writing reports that perhaps are read by very few people, that has no impact in terms of the decisions that we make, then that may be not an effective way to go. But if that information comes through and fed through into planning processes, stakeholder involvement, that it provides information as we move along about what may be happening, then I think that can be informative and helpful. But I would agree with you that the notion that simply getting more information is always better in terms of making informed decision, that's not the case. You can get detailed information in areas that won't really inform you at all about the system. So you need to be careful of where you get that information, and you also need to have systems built in place, processes built in place, that that information is utilized in an effective way. So I'd agree with you on that.
You suggested that integrated systems, or you presented an example that more integrated or connected systems may help build resilience, but also may sort of undermine resilience and adaptive capacity in other cases. What would your general advice be in, because we are trying to, I think, build our resilience and adaptive capacity by increasing connectivity, moving water around the landscape. Are we building more
resilient
systems in doing that or not?
Well, in terms of specifics, I can't answer you, but there is this view that increasing connectivity is a good thing. And that diagram I put up in the banking crisis and risk of defaults indicates that not necessarily. And that's also true of modeling that I've done as well, that it depends on the context. So the network structure itself helps to determine whether increased connectivity is a good thing or a bad thing on the context of being able to respond to shocks. So the view that just increasing connectivity is a good thing is false. It may be or it may not be. And I would argue that we'd want to look at those structures, those network structures. In more detail and to be able to make that determination.
And the kind of equivalence of capital adequacy, I suppose, at the
exactly.
Example. I think it's really good that this kind of dialogue is developing, and that's what we're hoping to achieve today, is an interaction between the government people that are here and the research community, between others that are from out there in the broader community as well. So keep up the discussion, and we'll now have a short break, but I'd like to thank Quentin again.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.